An unspeakable terror attack that succeeded in shocking the world, succeeded in triggering a massive overreaction that appalled the planet, and succeeded in stoking an escalation that's drawn in the entire region. Fortunately, not everyone is hell-bent on an all-out clash of civilizations in the Middle East. On the anniversary of the Hamas-led October 7th attack, at a time when public opinion in Israel supports the widening of the campaign into Lebanon and retaliation against Iran, some simple questions for a panel that instead wants to find the path to peaceful coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians. First off, where to start? How to address and process the genuine fear that's felt by both sides? And what can the international community do? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking about the future of the Middle East on this grim anniversary. Joining us from Tel Aviv, as a paramedic, he was a first responder on October 7th. Eran Nissan, also an activist, CEO of Mehaskim, I hope I pronounced that correctly, an organization that promotes progressive political content in Israeli social media. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening. Thank you.
From Abu Dhabi, Palestinian activist Samer Sinijlawi. He chairs the Jerusalem Fund for Education and Community Development. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
John Linden is executive director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, an umbrella group that brings together organizations that try to foment dialogue. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And France 24's Shirley Sitpon. Good to see you.
Hello.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24Debate. Yeah, among the commemorations we've seen this Monday, mourners returning to the site of the Nova Music Festival, where more than 360 were killed on October 7th of last year. Dozens taken hostage. President Isaac Herzog led the memorial, which began with the last track that was played at a party, at the party 1 year ago. It's been a day of emotions, Shirley Sitpon. That Nova Music Festival, you've been speaking to one of the survivors there.
Yes, she was yesterday in a ceremony here in Paris commemorating the attacks of October 7. Her name is Alina Tovberg, and Marie Schuster and I, our reporter, we went to meet with her. We went to the commemoration, of course, and she told us what happened that day. Since that day, when she survived, she was in the Nova Festival. She was a makeup artist there. She worked all night, body painting all night, and then it was the beginning of the attack, and she describes this whole process. Since then, she feels she has a mission to tell everyone what she saw on that day, so we can listen to her.
Look at this beautiful sunrise. That's when it all started. I finished this body painting, said hello, see?
Lives begin when fear's gone.
That's it. And then the next moment, you can see them firing at us 360 degrees. It came from all over. Those are the refrigerators. Eleanor hid in one of them. All the people who stayed in this area were killed, and she survived. This is when we got out of there. The smell was terrible. We're driving away and see corpses all along the road, all the way. Then we got to the cars that were all together. We were the last vehicle that managed to get through. They tried to run into our car, but the driver managed to turn at the last second and got into the bushes. The terrorists were everywhere. When we got to the gate of Kibbutz Re'im, it opened. Another miracle. God opened it for us. We got into a house in Re'im and hid there. That is really moving.
Yes, she says this is moving because at the same time as she was finishing her story, the prayer for the dead could be heard at the commemoration. And we can see some images that she sent us, she shared with us from that day, Hamas firing the rockets as she was still there. And then the images from Kibbutz Re'im, where she, well, those are images actually of her working all night. This is something that she's showing. She's showing across the world. And these are the images of Hamas. After fleeing the Nova Music Festival, they went to Re'im. And when they were in the house in Re'im, they were able to film what was going on outside. And she showed to us that they saw gunmen firing at the homes that were next to them. And many people got killed there, and that they survived, and that she feels that now she needs to talk about this. But still, a year later, you can feel that she's really lost, and that she feels completely disconnected from other people, from the rest of the world. Nobody, as she said, nobody can understand us. That's the feeling that she has.
Nobody can understand
that's
us.
That's what she says. I said, why do you have that feeling? Everybody says that what happened on October 7 is terrible, but then the war is horrible. And why do you feel that people don't understand? And then she says, well, there's a disconnection, explaining that there's a need to preserve relations in Israel between Jews, Arabs, whether Muslims or Christian, but that she feels completely disconnected from the rest of the world and completely disconnected from the Palestinians. I asked her several times the question, and I didn't really want to talk about it. She says that evil must disappear on both sides and that everything must be rebuilt. But yes, basically a lot of questions 1 year on.
It sounds like somebody desperately trying to stay out of politics, just be a makeup artist, but drawn in by it.
Exactly. That's exactly the feeling.
Aaron Nissan, tell us about your October 7th, then and now.
So first of all, thank you for having me, and it's good to see you, John and Samuel. I think that this is a very appropriate panel. So I'm a peace activist. I'm a peace activist because of my military service. I was a combat soldier in the Israeli Special Forces. The experiences that I had pushed me into taking a more positive and constructive and optimistic role as a peace activist, trying to promote an end to the violence and bloodshed. This was a decade ago. Aside from my work as a political and peace activist, I'm also a medic and an ambulance driver. I volunteer for Israel's medical, like emergency services, Magen David Adom. A year ago, I was with my wife, Shir. Her birthday is October 9th, so it was the weekend of her birthday. So we decided to go on a trip to southern Israel. And we were sleeping in a tent in Sde Boker in the middle of the desert. And we were woken up by sirens and distance explosions and push notifications in our phones telling us that something is happening. We quickly packed our things and got into the car and drove to Be'er Sheva, which is the biggest city in the southern district of Israel. And on the way, we understood from the videos on Telegram and WhatsApp and on Twitter that this is not just another escalation, that this is an invasion. And when we got to Be'er Sheva, I found myself in the hospital, in the Soroka hospital, offering help, seeing what I can do to help. And I arrived in the morning, it was like 9:30 a.m., to the entrance of the hospital just as the first wave of casualties arrived at the hospital. I remember the first person I treated was a soldier with a gunshot wound to the chest. And after that, I just stayed running between the ICU, the emergency room, and the front desk, trying to deal with what is called a textbook mass casualty events. And I treated soldiers and police officers wounded from the fighting, but also Bedouin kids that from unrecognized communities in the Negev that were hit by rockets and survivors from the Nova Festival. And it was a contrast between the chaos and the bloodshed and the trauma that was happening outside and the perseverance and determination of the medical staff in the Soroka Hospital. And what is the most important thing to understand is that 20% of the Israeli society are Palestinian citizens of Israel. our society is very complex. And sometimes from the outside, it seems like this conflict is between Israelis and Palestinians. But I think that the narrative of October 7th for me, and that shaped also how I experienced it up until this day, is that I was surrounded by Jews and Arabs that are dedicated to saving lives, that are working shoulder to shoulder in order to save lives of Jews and Arabs. And this only re-emphasized what I already knew before as a peace activist, that we are in this together. And this war and this conflict and this fight is not between Israelis and Palestinians or Jews and Muslims or Jews and Arabs. It's between Jews and Arabs who understand that our future here is together and that our faiths are intertwined and interconnected, and Jews and Arabs that believe in some kind of supremacy that support violence and they're trying to make us fear and hate each other.
People react differently to what you describe there as a mass casualty situation. Earlier, we were speaking with Yaniv Yegi. He is he hunkered down with his family at Kibbutz Be'eri on the day. And he said, quote, that he used to be, an activist for peace like yourself, but with the Palestinians, quote, we're not good neighbors. We need time apart. Your reaction?
I think that we had time apart. I think that the illusion of trying to think that we are over here and they are over there, the 17 years siege of the Gaza Strip. You know, the older generation, if you meet Palestinians from Gaza, that are over 55 years of age, they speak Hebrew. My dad was born in Iran. He's fluent in Arabic. He spoke to his Iraqi parents in Arabic. Our parents, they were living together. It wasn't perfect. There was occupation. There was inequality. There was discrimination. But Israelis and Palestinians used to meet. Since I was born in the early 90s, and specifically in the early 2000s, with the building of the separation wall, and after the Gaza disengagement in 2005, we are in the reality of being apart.
Yaniv said on that point was he still believes it's possible, that peace is not impossible, but that it's going to take decades of education because he has felt a lot of hate.
So first of all, the trauma is shaping our lives and our narratives. But I learned, you have John in the studio with you. We have seen how conflicts end, how from realities that we think that this is impossible and it will take lifetimes and maybe my grandchildren will be able to live together. And in a matter of years, when there is enough resources, when there is enough infrastructure, where there is the combination of top-down pressure and bottom-up pressure that sandwiches the political leadership into making the courageous political choices, we can change things dramatically. And we saw it. We saw it. You know, the generation of my parents, they used to hid in bomb shelters from Jordanian bomb attacks. And just this week, Jordanian fighter pilots were shooting down missiles from Iran. We know that the only way that we can live a safe and secure life here is through political agreements and regional alliances, and understand that we need to understand that we are not a villa in the jungle, but we live in a neighborhood. It's a challenging and complicated neighborhood, but we need to rely on our neighbors, not just the Egyptians and the Jordanians, but maybe most of all, our Palestinian neighbors. And I live in Jaffa. Jaffa is mixed, Jews and Arabs. Around 70% of the people who live in Jaffa, Israeli citizens, Palestinians, have first relatives in Gaza. And just this week, last Tuesday, there was a shooting attack in Jaffa, here, 5 minutes from here. And me and my wife were there. And again, I had to treat Jews and Arabs that were hit by terrorists from Hebron, but that our communities are affected because of that there are people who are using violence. But we are stronger than the fear and the hate. And I'm sorry for what you said, and it's understandable to be so close to trauma. And there are suspicion and distrust, and it's understandable. But there is important and amazing work being done by people like John and Olmec and people like Samuel to build this trust, because the only way that we can build trust is through healing together, not apart.
Samir Sinid Jalawi, we're commemorating an anniversary, Israel's the bloodiest day in Israel's history. In the 364 that followed, Gaza's been in parts reduced to rubble. From a Palestinian perspective, how are Aaron Nissan's words ringing?
Well, it's ringing. I'm really very thankful for him to speak out this way, because, you know, this conflict has brought us to a level that both sides, we started believing that everything is permissible. We can do whatever we want to the other side. And that's what has happened on the 7th of October. And that's what has been happening the whole year in Gaza, justifying killing of kids for a good cause. I really cannot see how we as human beings can accept any side, kill any kid, anywhere. One kid to be killed is enough tragedy. But let me tell you something. We need to start learning not to continue looking with two eyes to the past. If we continue looking into the 7th October and into the days of war in Gaza, we will stuck there forever. We need at least to shift one eye to the future. And I think that whatever the results of the war will be, when it ends, and I don't know when it will end, tomorrow or in 1 year, we both, Israelis and Palestinians, we will find ourselves again, millions of Palestinians and millions of Israelis, living in the same piece of land, and we will discover that maybe what we thought is the best strategy for both of us, the result of violence or the choice of a war of no choice, was the wrong choices. We should be able to find a way for a peace of no choice. There will be never any safety, any security, any justice, any freedom for Israelis and Palestinians in this piece of land, in this corner of land, if we are not able to find a way of coexistence. And whether we like it or not, the only way to be able to accommodate the needs of the Jewish people into living in their own Jewish democratic state is for them to separate from millions of Palestinians. But there are things that should be done. And I think, well, maybe Israelis can live another 50 years in this conflict. Okay, they are paying a price. They have pain. They have grief. They are sending their kids to the army, which is not comfortable. But they have a nice country. They have a nice state. They can wait another 34 years until they are comfortable to find a way out of this conflict. But we Palestinians, we cannot wait another 50 hours in this conflict. So maybe we have more responsibility into trying to find a way out of this conflict. I believe, despite all these sadness and grief and trauma, that most of Israelis, most of Palestinians, deep inside, they are looking for a way out of this conflict. I believe that the mainstream majority of both sides would like to live in the two separated countries, neighboring each other in friendly relations. But maybe we are confused on both sides.
Let me bring in France 24 correspondent Iris Makler, who joins us from that commemoration that's been taking place in a public park in Tel Aviv. Iris, just to rebound, what do most Israelis think on this first anniversary?
I think it's a mixture of sorrow and wrath. I mean, what we've seen here are stories so sad I can hardly bring myself to recount them. You know, there was a list of all the names of the 1,200 people who died going up in a roller, and that takes a while. There was a memorial prayer. These are very, very sad stories that we've heard here tonight, some for the first time, some not. So all of this sorrow here is nevertheless accompanied, I would say, by wrath at the abandonment of the government, by the fact that it is the same government, that they had to organize this ceremony themselves because they didn't want to take part in the government one, which isn't being held in public like this one is. And the only round of applause I've heard here tonight was when a father of one of the spotters, the observers, as those young women who are in the army are called, that he said it's time for a commission of inquiry, a state commission of inquiry, to find out what went wrong, how the army made its mistakes, how the security services made their mistakes, how Israel's intelligence services made their mistakes, and most of all, how the politicians made their mistakes. And that was really resonated here, and that's part of the anger, I think, of the public at Benjamin Netanyahu's government and the Prime Minister himself. And the fact that there's been no accountability, and because this is an unpopular government, it's clinging to power, there's no mention of elections. So all of that together, the dissatisfaction with the politicians and the enormous sorrow at what they've been through.
Yeah, so let's talk about the politicians. And you mentioned it, this is not an official ceremony you're at. Far from the crowd and from the press, Israel's prime minister paid a closed-door visit in the company of the mayor of Jerusalem to a memorial commemorating the attack of 1 year ago and put out this video message.
The October 7th massacre was the most horrific attack on the Jewish people since the Holocaust. But unlike the Holocaust, we rose up against our enemies and fought back. We are changing security reality in our region. For the sake of our children, for the sake of our future, to ensure that what happened on October 7th will not happen again. Never again.
We are changing the security reality in the region, said the Prime Minister. How many Israelis support him on that, more broadly, those that are outside of the park you're standing in?
It's an interesting question. There is a feeling, I think, that something had to be done. I don't think you'll find many Israelis who didn't support a war in Gaza at the beginning. And I don't think you'll find many Israelis who don't support some kind of military action in Lebanon. Because, you know, there are so many tens of thousands of Israelis who are not in their homes in the north. I should also say tens of thousands of Lebanese displaced in the south of their country. So it's been very costly in civilian terms on both sides of that line in the north. And Israelis want to return home, and they want the people of the north to return home, to their homes. So I think there is support. Is there support for the way this government is running it? Is there support for the fact that there doesn't seem to be an end game either in Gaza or at the moment, as far as we can see, in Lebanon? And, you know, Iran is a whole new game. I've been reporting on a covert war here between Israel and Iran for more than a decade. It's an overt war now, and we don't know the rules. So I have heard military analysts saying that if you don't know where you're going, you don't get anywhere. And I think that criticism is made of this government. In every poll I've seen, even in polls where the Likud party, that's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party, is rising, nevertheless, you know, the right-wing coalition would not win government in any election that's held at the moment. So that tells you a lot, too. There's dissatisfaction with this prime minister who doesn't, you know, talks about the greatest tragedy the Jewish people has suffered, but doesn't put his hand up to what part of that he's accountable for.
Iris Machler reporting live from Tel Aviv. Many thanks for joining us here in the France 24 debate. John Linton, this escalation, this widening of the conflict, It's paying dividends. Full confession, by the way. We've been talking nonstop in this studio for the past 2 weeks, ever since those pagers detonated, about the Middle East. And, well, we've given scant mention to the Palestinians, even though this has all started with October 7th and the war with Gaza. Your thoughts on the fact that, you know, widening the conflict seems to be working for Netanyahu.
Yeah, I mean, if the role is to try and obfuscate the underlying issues that have led to this disaster, then widening the lens to the entire region is a helpful way to do that. The anniversary of October 7th today has been the first time for a long time, I think, that we've narrowed things back to not just the Israel-Palestine track, and particularly the devastating events of October 7th and the fallout for both Palestinians and for Israelis since, but also the human beings. I feel like we've been talking about weapon systems, pagers, Mossad operations, grand geopolitics. None of these things are unimportant, but they begin to sort of obscure and even dehumanize the real story, which is millions of Israelis and Palestinians, roughly 50% of both populations who live between the Mediterranean and the Jordan, and finding a way for them to be able to share that land in equality, peace, justice, and security is the ballgame. That's how we fix almost all of these problems. And I feel like I feel like it's perhaps in the interest of some politicians to move the lens into that wider sort of animation in order, number one, to try and maybe recover some sense of lost credibility because of the insecurity many Israelis feel. There's also, and I don't mean this in an unkind way, but for traumatized people, there is an immediate, almost visceral positive reaction to seeing your side being able to deploy violence tactically in a devastating and very effective way. Right, so there is a way the tactical operations that we've seen from a pure, narrow kind of military analysis perspective, many Israelis I know, even those in the center left, they feel a sense of pride that Israel is able to volley back a reply to its enemies and be able to actually operate something that goes from start to finish very successfully, because the big failures of October 7th from an intelligence and a military perspective are a big part of the sense of insecurity right now. But these are all just tactics. And unless they're wedded to a larger strategy, then it's hard to understand how they're going to actually lead to any place that's much better for Palestinians and for Israelis.
Are we having this conversation too soon? Talking about overcoming the fear and trauma, finding the common ground. Can you do it while there's still shooting going on?
Yes. Well, I mean, first of all, the shooting needs to stop. I mean, the most important and urgent priority needs to be a ceasefire. Everything is linked to ending the war between Israel and Gaza. It's very, very clear. And we were very close to it in the middle of the summer. And that opportunity was squandered. And there's some very, very thorough reporting that can explain the reasons for why that took place.
But when was it squandered exactly?
Towards the end of July. When
Ismail Haniyeh was assassinated?
Part of the story was that there was changes in with regards to the terms of reference. These are leaks coming from the negotiators themselves. This isn't my theory. And there was also, at an earlier point, both Hamas and the Netanyahu government have changed their positions at different times. So the misalignment has meant that we hadn't gotten to a deal. But ultimately, if you want to see Israelis return to their homes in the north of Israel, if you want to see Palestinians in Gaza begin to rebuild from the devastation we've seen in the last year, people to return to the kibbutzim, a sense of security in the wider region, rockets and missiles stopping being fired from every single direction, all eyes need to be on how we end the initial escalation inside Gaza and move to this other phase we've been talking about, which is the kind of the next day, this sort of reconstruction, but also diplomatic horizon that's been completely missing and that some people want to avoid, I think, for as long as possible. But you asked a question about whether it's possible for traumatized people to be able to engage in conflict resolution. And Jonathan Zigan, who I think was with you earlier on today, the son of an incredible peace builder, Vivian Silver, who was a very important figure in our community. I think probably most people on this call or this show met her at some point. He said something very powerful in an event that we did with him a few months ago, that every conflict that's ever been resolved anywhere in the world was resolved by traumatized people, by definition. If you aren't traumatized, you haven't been in conflict, right? And we have now the most traumatization we've seen amongst Israelis and Palestinians ever. And I think also the greatest sense of urgency to change things. Polling shows that both Israelis and Palestinians are incredibly dissatisfied with the status quo, that they want to see very different realities emerge in its place. And what we need to make sure, I think Iran said it earlier, you can't beat something with nothing. We have to make sure that peace builders, diplomacy, those that want nonviolence and partnership, have a compelling vision that can take, yes, traumatized people, but make them really believe that a vision based on partnership, diplomacy, civil society, nonviolence stacks up and can deliver them the security that they really want to see, as well as the self-determination and the rights that are missing right now.
Shall we sit on?
Yes, I guess that Benjamin Netanyahu, he had one success according to his vision, is that he managed a majority of Israelis to feel that there is no solution, that the situation is just going to continue anyway, and that way, well, can continue with
him or
someone
else. Is that a vast majority?
I believe so, because when you talk to people who the days of Rabin and the days of Barak were in favor of a two-state solution, that believed that there was hope, well, you talk to them today, they feel like they were fools, because you know, they tell me that those who changed their minds, of course, at the time, they said there is no hope, there is no solution. And when you tell them, well, you have to find a solution, what are you hoping for in the future? Well, they come up with, not with a two-state solution, but some kind of an arrangement, things that they wouldn't even have dared suggested years ago, saying that, well, the Israelis will continue to occupy parts of the West Bank. I mean, things that are not, but you tell them, but this is still occupation. That's not a two-state solution. But they say, well, that's impossible, a two-state solution. So changing people's minds, it's terrible. I mean, you feel that there was a whole a vast part of a society that changed completely their mindset. And that's what's so disheartening. You feel that there's a lot of work to do, but of course it's possible. But the first idea is to put forward the solution. The international community should show that there are options, not letting them believe what Netanyahu is telling them, that there is a two-state solution is impossible because you cannot trust the other side. Yes, you can. There are solutions. So maybe that's what all the other partners, they have to explain this, to show this very clearly, not just say, of course, there needs to be a ceasefire, but also explaining the next phases and just maybe, you know, forcing the Israelis to listen to this at least. That way they can know that it's possible and they can change their mind.
Aaron Nissan, you heard Shirley Sitbon say the words international community. 12 months ago, a lot of people thought, well, this will go on for a while, and then at some point, the United States will call time on things. Didn't happen. Is it up to the international community?
So, yes and no. I'll start with the no, we'll end on the yes. The no part is that the international community needs to change the mindset. The international community must understand, and it needs to come, first of all, from the governments, but not just the governments, that they should stop. They need to stop trying to be architects, treating Israel-Palestine like a drawing board, thinking about political process as a transactional thing, and trying to orchestrate all the interests and like they're building a building. This is not going to work. What we need is that the international community will start taking the role of a midwife that understands that it's not about you, it's about us. Israelis and Palestinians need to deliver this peace, and the international community's role is to offer expertise and support, and like a good midwife, to understand that you're not going to ignore the pain, but you're going to harness the pain into constructive roots. So the first part is we need to empower Israelis and Palestinians to lead, because this would create the public pressure, the narrative, the hope, the political imagination required to push the political leadership to taking the courageous acts. As we know, politicians are not leaders usually. They need to be pushed or persuaded to do these things. So this is the no part. We need to be the leaders, Israelis and Palestinians, and I will emphasize young Israelis and young Palestinians. But we need the international community because we cannot do this alone. And in the last G7 summit, we heard the leaders of the G7 reaffirm their commitment, not just for legitimizing the civil society work, but actually putting their money where their values are. And what we need is that the international community will recruit to support the peace builders, not just with tweets and stories on Instagram, although tweets and stories on Instagram are really important in legitimizing our voices, not just by hosting us and opening up spaces for young Israelis and young Palestinians to meet outside the region, because right now it's impossible because of the permits regime imposed by Israel that prevents peace activists like myself to meet my counterparts from Ramallah or Jenin or Nablus. But what we need is that the international community to double down on financing and supporting the peace-building efforts, this necessary infrastructure. So we need the international community. We need the things that they have a comparative advantage at. We need the private sector. We need the intergovernmental organizations like the EU. We need the judicial institutions like the ICC to ICJ to play a constructive role here. We need the governments to not choose sides and align by pro-Israel or pro-Palestine, but to use incentives but to also use the pressure that they can exert in order to promote, to pave a way forward for peace. But it has to be in the context of being a midwife and not an architect.
Samer Sinijlawi, you're right now speaking to us from the Gulf. What about Arab states? Can they be that international community?
Well, I lost hope from the international community, honestly. They are very hypocritic when it comes to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, especially the USA. The international community is the USA. The only player that can do something in this conflict is the USA. And if, in theory, tomorrow Rashida Tlaib will be elected as the president of the USA, USA will not push the sides to do something and to exit this conflict. Now, the Arab world is very divided, unfortunately. You can see one country that is playing a very positive role. It's United Arab Emirates. United Arab Emirates have, first of all, 4 years ago, took a very courageous step in signing the Abraham Accords with Israel. And it managed to maintain and sustain its positive relations and influence. Now Israel cannot say no to United Arab Emirates when it comes to anything in Gaza.
What about
That's
neighboring Jordan?
Well, I think Jordan is too weak to influence the United States or the Israelis. But what about Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia, I think, up till now, they decided to distance themselves, not to be involved. It's very dangerous for them to invest effort now. They don't want to assess risk. If all the Arab countries start playing the role that the United Arab Emirates plays, it will be a different region. I'll give you an example. Yesterday, I flew out of Tel Aviv airport, Ben Gurion airport. And on the departure screen there, in half an hour, 30 minutes, I saw five Emirati flights departing out of Tel Aviv to Dubai and up. Why? All the other American and European flights were canceled. So canceling flights during war or increasing the number of flights is not a commercial decision, it's political. And again here, United Arab Emirates proves to Israel that all its long-term problems and challenges can be solved regionally, not far away in USA or Europe. If the Israelis open the door for peace with Saudis and the Palestinians, the whole Middle East will change. We will be able to be the bloc that will stand strong against the mutual enemy we have, the strategic enemy, the strategic challenge, the Iranian. But we need to understand this important moment. The Israeli political elite needs to feel the potential that we have here to change the face of the Middle East.
John Linden, you agree?
Yeah, I mean, in general, what Samer and Iran have been articulating is a disruptive vision. It's how we get from where we are now to somewhere much, much better. It's really not depending upon the United States or Europe to come and save the day. There's no white knights arriving from the international community. We've seen that very clearly, not just in the last year, but in the last decade. The world had forgotten about Israel-Palestine, and it deprioritized it. And we should really ask some searching questions about why it took the most horrific events a year ago today, and then the devastation of the war over the last year, for this issue to be on the agendas of prime ministers and presidents, when actually we could have addressed it earlier and saved an awful lot of lives. But again, we are where we are. I think what Samer and Iran are talking about, though, is about bringing in the region not as a partner, but actually as a core player who are able to offer real things to Israelis and Palestinians that, frankly, Europeans and Americans are increasingly not able to offer. That's around a regional security architecture. So Israelis are traumatized and they're scared and they feel insecure, and they can see that a coalition involving, yes, European countries and the United States, but also Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, shot down Iranian projectiles on two different instances over the last year, and that they are offering genuine security via regional integration and the creation of something akin to NATO in the Middle East that can really provide strategic depth to Israel. And Israelis know at some level that the place they're safest is where they have peace deals with Egypt, with Jordan, And the places that are least safe is where they have been having military operations and ongoing military occupation in the instance of West Bank and Gaza for recent decades. So I feel like after this war, there'll be an ability to be able to make that case. It's hard during the war. And we've seen polling.
This is what you were saying a year ago, by the way. Once the war's over, people will...
Well, I think the bit of self-reflection for me, and there's many things, but one thing is I really did not anticipate that this war would go on for a year. I've got to say, one of the things that I've been thinking most about today are the things that we miscalculated early on in the war. I wrote emails that I'd like to take back about ideas that would be possible in the spring or early summer of this year, of 2024. And the reality is that we've allowed the situation to deteriorate month on month and to expand. But looking now into year two of this war, we should be able to learn from the things that we've gotten wrong over the last 12 months. And I mean, we very, very broadly, the international community, Israeli and Palestinian civil society actors, local forces, regional actors as well. And, you know, you came from the, Iris gave a report from the ceremony for the families of hostages in Tel Aviv today. That's a civil society initiative. That was put together by civil society. The people are on the streets calling for a ceasefire and an exchange of hostages. They are civil society organizations. The people saving lives in the south on October 7th, including Iran, were very often civil society volunteers. The people in the West Bank protecting Palestinians from attacks by settlers are very often civil society activists. The people producing ideas that are going to help to disrupt this current moment are almost all civil society actors. Israel-Palestine is cursed in many ways with some terrible luck in recent decades. One of its true blessings is it has one of the most vibrant, creative, determined, and strategic civil society networks I've ever seen. And what I don't understand is why the way diplomacy is organized is the most elite-driven instance of diplomacy I've ever seen in any conflict.
Because it's all about a photo op.
Yeah, it's smoke-filled rooms and the idea that we can cook things up in the background and then impose them in the region. As Iran said, we need to midwife what we see in the region, which is people like Samer in Iran that are ready to really take risks in order to find a much better future for Israelis and Palestinians.
There's been a lot of coverage here, of course, in the build-up to this anniversary here in France, home to Europe's largest Jewish and largest Muslim community. We saw that the French and the Americans tried to broker a three-week truce between Hezbollah and Israel. That's come to naught so far. And we saw a weekend spat between the French and Israeli leaders over Emmanuel Macron's threat of an arms embargo. Macron, by the way, dispatching his new foreign minister to Israel for commemorations. Jean-Noël Barrot's presence, a reminder that there were 48 French nationals killed on the day, Shirley Sitbon, and that there are still French citizens being held captive in Gaza. When you reflect on the past year reporting on this from France, what's your takeaway?
Well, that there's a lot of criticism here about the way this is the place France, what France is doing in the region, because there's a feeling of weakness that it's, for example, what you were talking about in recent days, Macron trying to take a stand in an odd moment just before October 7th, but saying, well, this is escalating, so we need to do something. So let's call to have some kind of embargo on some of the weapons sent to Israel, not the defensive ones, but the ones used in Gaza and that destroy in Gaza. Well, then he gets this unprecedented rebuke from the Israeli prime minister, extremely violent. And after that, very shortly later, the presidential palace here says, well, we're still your best friends. Don't worry. It's not seen in a very positive way here. People maybe want to see something that brings more solutions. Say, we've seen many protests and a lot of division. And with people protesting, of course, to stop the bombing in Gaza. But at the same time, the political leaders who say that, they don't bring other solutions. So there's a feeling of division that we want violence to stop. But what are we suggesting? How are we playing on the facts? I mean, that the international community should not be the ones bringing in the solutions. But sometimes in the past, there have been some ideas. And when you have the impression that we're basically no one's navigating this here in France, and that the Jewish community, many people in the Jewish community feel they're abandoned and nobody understands them. At the same time, other people are shocked by the violence in Gaza, and they don't understand that there isn't enough reaction here in France politically, on the media, Well, there's really a lack of understanding between people. When you follow all of the exchanges, a lot of violence, using more the words Zionist, but with extremely brutal about, you know, what is a Zionist? It's not just Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. It's people who are for the existence of Israel sometimes. That's the way it's interpreted sometimes. So hearing so much violence, saying everything is because of the Zionists, they're Zionist killers, they're criminals. Hearing that all day long, seeing that on social media all day long, it's a lot of violence here in society. And that's why we're also seeing more and more violence between people here.
Verbal violence.
Yeah, and also like our debate in Europe has become so warped and dehumanized and racist and unhelpful, right? Like really, really unhelpful, both in the parameters it sets down for political leaders, the way in which it alienates and scares diaspora communities, the way in which Israelis and Palestinians feel betrayed or othered or dehumanized by it as well. And I think, I know I'm a bit of a broken record on this, if we scaled the work of people like Iran and Samer, number one, it will directly shift the politics and the diplomatic horizon in the region. But number two, it communicates a very different reality to the streets of Paris or Brussels or New York or Berlin, where you see Israelis and Palestinians, Arabs and Jews coming together in a network of solidarity that is in itself very disruptive and political. It's, you know, not just getting together and being allies and colleagues. It's about challenging the status quo in a way that's more efficacious than what many politicians are trying to do. And if you imagine even, now I'm going to say, I'm going to do the thing that I was criticizing.
Quickly, because we're out of time.
Well, we could broaden the lens and look at the wider region. Samer's in Abu Dhabi right now. There's no reason why there aren't people in Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, the UAE, the wider region who can make common cause with Israelis and Palestinians who share their idea of a future based on justice, equality, self-determination, and dignity. Imagine us helping set that up and how that might shift the dynamic in the youngest region in the world.
All right, a call for more midwives there from John Linden. I want to thank Aaron Nissan for being with us from Tel Aviv, Samir Sinjilawi in Abu Dhabi, John, Shirley Sitbaum, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.